Welcome to The Bloody Bible, the podcast where we explore why our fascination with crime is as old as the Bible itself. I'm Kaz.
And I'm Em. And we're starting off season two by focusing on one of the most fascinating, notorious, and infamous women in the Bible.
You're talking about Eve, aren't you?
You're correct, Kaz. You got it in one. Eve only appears in three chapters of the Bible, Genesis chapters 2-4. But my goodness, she leaves quite a legacy, doesn't she?
She sure does, yeah.
Theologians and biblical scholars have spilled gallons of ink writing about her, and artists, musicians, and authors have been inspired by her. And sure, Adam gets some attention too, but he really shares her spotlight.
That's so true. Adam is definitely outshone by Eve every single time. She's just so much more interesting than him. But why do you think Eve has become such a cultural icon? Why are we so fascinated by her?
So I think Eve is famous for a whole lot of reasons. She's the first female character mentioned in the Bible, created by God in Genesis 2, as a partner for Adam. She's also the first biblical mother and gives birth to three sons, Cain, Abel, and Seth. In Hebrew, her name means life, and Adam declares that she's the mother of all living. So in lots of ways, she's a pretty groundbreaking character.
Yeah, she certainly is.
But first and foremost, I think she's gained her notoriety by being the Bible's first rule-breaking woman. We all know her story. She listened to the serpent and chose to eat the forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge. She shared it with Adam, effectively making him her accomplice. And because of that, God banished them both from paradise.
So do you think that Eve's reputation as a rule breaker has catapulted her to fame?
Yeah, I do. She refuses to play by the rules. She follows her own desires. She acts with agency. She's a truly transgressive figure.
Okay, so how are we going to tackle Eve in this episode, Em?
Right, so I want us to explore Eve's reputation as a rule breaker, focusing in particular on some of the more negative evaluations of her character. So we'll take a look at Eve's portrayal in Genesis and think about how interpretations of these texts have impacted attitudes towards women throughout history and up to the present day. And along the way, I'm hoping that you'll share some examples of contemporary true crime cases that remind you of Eve. Does that sound okay?
Definitely. It sounds brilliant.
So just a heads up to our listeners, we'll be touching briefly on the topics of rape and intimate partner violence, so please take care as you listen. And as usual, we'll leave some links to relevant support services in our show notes.
So Em, you mentioned that Eve's reputation as a rule breaker has impacted attitudes about women. Why do you think that is?
So often Eve is assumed to represent the essence or prototype of womankind. Eve disobeyed God. She listened to the serpent. She ate the forbidden fruit and shared it with Adam. And because of that, all women are believed to be just like her, easily tempted, prone to disobedience, and liable to lead the men in their lives into a whole lot of trouble.
So in other words, Eve becomes every woman, is that right?
Exactly. All women are deemed to be just like Eve, and this in turn impacts how they're treated. Let me give you a few examples of early Christian writings that promote this idea. To start us off, the author of the New Testament text 1 Timothy uses Eve to justify women's submission to men. Do you want to read it out, Kaz?
Sure. So this is 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 11-14. And I'm quoting here, "Let a woman learn in silence with full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She is to keep silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor." Okay, so in essence, all women have to remain silent and submissive to male authority because Eve is secondary in creation and because she was deceived by the serpent. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And throughout Christian history, right up to the present day, some church communities use this text and this line of thinking to prevent women's leadership in churches. But they're by no means the first to use this argument against women. Following on from the author of 1 Timothy, a number of theologians in the early church continued in this tradition. I've sent you a few quotes, Kaz. Could you read them out for us?
Sure. So this first one's from Jerome, one of the church fathers who was writing in the 4th and early 5th centuries. And he warns clergymen that, and I'm quoting, "A woman's foot must never cross the threshold of your humble lodging. Remember always that a woman," we're presuming he's talking about Eve, "drove the tiller of paradise from the garden that had been given him." Okay. And just in case Jerome hasn't made it clear enough that he's a misogynist, he also describes women as the root of all evil. And then we have another church father, Tertullian, who was writing during the 2nd and 3rd centuries. He tells women the following: "And do you not know that you are each an Eve? The sentence of God on this sex of yours lives in this age. The guilt must of necessity live too. You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that tree. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil was not valiant enough to attack. You destroyed so easily God's image, man. On account of your desert, that is death, even the Son of God had to die."
Tertullian, eh?
Yeah, it's really toxic, isn't it?
Mm.
So it seems to me that these church fathers essentially believe that women ruin everything, don't they? Women are presumed to be just like Eve, and so they're associated with ungodliness, guilt, deception, death, and even the demonic. They're weak and easily tempted, but they're also dangerous temptresses who can bring about men's downfall. Oh, this whole Eve as every woman ideology is just so hateful, so misogynistic.
It really, really is. And as I mentioned earlier, it continued to be used throughout the centuries to define rule-breaking women. A later example is the 15th century witch hunter's manual, Malleus Maleficarum, written by Catholic priest Heinrich Kramer, who argued for the torture and execution of people, particularly women, who were believed to practice sorcery. Let me read out a quote from that book. It says, "In the Old Testament, the scriptures have much that is evil to say about women, and this is because of the first temptress, Eve, and her imitators."
Whoa, yeah. But these ideas about all women inheriting Eve's bad habits aren't just a thing of the past, are they? I actually came across something similar recently in a popular so-called self-help book written for Christian women, which was published just a few years ago. It's called Lies Women Believe, and its central premise is that women have inherited Eve's propensity to believe lies. Eve believed the serpent's lies, so women too are destined to believe lies that lead them into misery and sin.
Huh. What kind of lies?
Most of the lies seem to be about women's desire for agency and control over their own lives, as well as their desire not to be subordinated and oppressed by men. So, according to the author, women believe lies such as, and I'm quoting, "I have rights. If I submit to my husband, I'll be miserable. I shouldn't have to suffer. And I have the right to control my reproductive choices."
Ah, so these are apparently lies women believe?
Well, yes, according to the author of this book.
So this idea that Eve is every woman isn't just a thing of the past, right?
No.
I'm not exaggerating when I say that it has had a massively harmful impact on women's religious and social lives throughout history and up to the present day. For centuries, biblical scholars and religious leaders have used this myth to oppress women, arguing that women are not equal to men, that they're prone to disobedience and sin, and that they're a corrupting influence on men. Women must, by necessity, remain subordinated to male authority. So I think it's important to interrogate the assumptions made about Eve and to push back against them, because they're so often used to justify and perpetuate patriarchy, misogyny, and sexism in real and tangible ways.
Yeah, I completely agree. So where do we begin, Em?
Let's start by having a quick look at Genesis 2, where we read about Eve's creation. Kez, can you read out verses 18 to 23?
Sure, yeah. So just to give a bit of context, in verses 7 to 8, God creates the first human creature out of the dust of the ground. And the creature's name in Hebrew is Ha'adam, which can be translated as either the man or the human. And God puts Ha'adam in the Garden of Eden to look after it. Then in verse 18, we read, I'm quoting, "The Lord God said, 'It is not good that Ha'adam should be alone. I will make them a helper as their partner. Now, God first creates all the animals, but none of them were suitable as a partner for Ha-Adam. So in verse 21 and following, we read, "The Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Ha-Adam. Then God took one of Ha-Adam's sides and closed up its place with flesh. And the side that the Lord God had taken from Ha-Adam, he made into a woman and brought her to Ha-Adam. Then Ha-Adam said, 'This at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called woman, for from a man this one was taken.'"
Thanks. So if you'll remember, the author of 1 Timothy used this account of Eve's creation to argue that all women were subordinate to men, because Eve was created after the man.
Yes, and Eve's creation seems to be derivative, doesn't it? Ha-Adam is created from raw materials, the dust of the ground, but Eve was crafted from a part of Ha-Adam's body, so she depends on it for her existence. Ha-Adam, who later becomes known as Adam, confirms this in verse 23 when he said, "This one shall be called woman, for from a man this one was taken."
Yeah, and that's certainly another part of the argument often used to claim women's secondary status. But some biblical scholars, including feminist scholar Carol Myers and womanist scholar Wilda Gaffney, suggest that the original human that God created is not a man or a male figure, but rather a human creature who embodies both the male and female genders. As you said, Kaz, the Hebrew term Ha-Adam can be translated as either the man or the human. So when God creates the woman, he's essentially separating the genders that are cohabiting within the body of Ha-Adam, the human.
Okay, so that would mean the woman wasn't created second after all, right? All the genders, including male and female, were co-created together and simultaneously in the body of the first human. But later, God decides to separate them into two distinct bodies. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the argument. And it aligns with the creation account in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, where we're told that God created humanity in his image, male and female, he created them. What's more, rather than Eve being derivative of the man, she actually plays a vital role in his creation. I read a really great chapter recently by the utterly brilliant biblical scholar Sione Javier, and he describes the creation process as follows. When woman came alive, the leftover of Ha-Adam, the human, became man. And the side effect of woman coming into being was man also coming into being. In this Moana reading, woman co-created with God, man. This reading celebrates woman co-creating with God.
Oh, I really love that interpretation, because it reframes Eve's creation as like the primary event rather than an afterthought. And rather than her being derivative, she's placed center stage, while the man is what's left following her creation. I love it. But what about verse 18, where God describes this new creation as the man's helper and partner? I know this verse is sometimes used to reinforce the idea that Eve was created for the man, to meet his needs, to help him. So she's naturally subordinated to him. That's the argument that's often put forward. Can you tell us anything about the Hebrew word that's translated here as helper?
Sure. So the Hebrew phrase is ezer kenegdo, and it's usually translated as helper as his partner, or suitable companion, or if we look at the King James version of the Bible, a helpmeet for him. Now, the word ezer means helper and is mostly used elsewhere in the Bible to describe God helping a person who's in trouble. So, for example, in the well-known opening verses of Psalm 121, the psalmist says, "I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where will my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth."
So in the Hebrew Bible, someone who gives help is not necessarily inferior to the person they're helping. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. God's the helper here.
Right.
Now in Genesis 2 verse 18, the word helper is modified by the Hebrew phrase kenegdo, which again doesn't suggest any kind of inferiority. We can translate this phrase literally as like opposite him or like corresponding to him. So God wants to create a helper for the human who is equivalent to him or as a counterpart to him.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's an equal partnership, not a hierarchical relationship involving a superior man and a subordinate woman.
So overall, there's nothing in the Genesis 2 account of Eve's creation to suggest that she is inferior to the man. Her creation facilitates the simultaneous creation of the man, and God intends her to be an equal partner and helper for the man.
That's the argument, yeah.
Right. But what about Genesis 3, when Eve meets the serpent and things start to go pear-shaped, or should I say apple-shaped?
Kaz, your jokes are terrible.
Sorry.
But yes, things do start to go wrong when Eve encounters the serpent. Back in Genesis 2, God had told the human that, quote, "You may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall die."
But that doesn't stop Eve, does it?
It does not. Could you read the first seven verses of Genesis chapter 3 for us, please, Kaz?
Sure. Okay, here we go. "Now the serpent was more clever than any other wild animal that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God say, you shall not eat from any tree in the garden?' The woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, nor shall you touch it, or you shall die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.' So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her man, who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves."
So the first question I want to ask you, Kaz, is why do you think the serpent spoke to Eve rather than Adam?
Well, I have heard it suggested that the serpent chose Eve because she was the weaker of the two humans. And I mean weaker in the sense that she was more gullible or easier to tempt or deceive. And from that interpretation, we get the suggestion that all women are prone to being easily tempted and led astray. They can't be trusted to make rational decisions. They believe anything they hear. They've no willpower. And that's certainly the argument laid out in that so-called self-help book I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and it also comes out in some of the quotes you read out from 1 Timothy in the Church Fathers. Eve was deceived, but Adam was not, so all women are likewise believed to have this weakness in their character.
But is it really a weakness? When I read these verses, I see the serpent encouraging Eve to think very carefully about God's prohibition. This fruit can give her immense knowledge. She will know everything there is to know about good and evil, just like God. And that's quite a compelling sales pitch by the serpent, because knowledge is a good thing, right?
Exactly. And Eve doesn't just blindly eat the fruit without thinking it through. In verse 6, we're told that she looks at the fruit and recognises that it's a source of good, tasty-looking food, which will also give her wisdom. She listened to the serpent's advice, understood it, and then made an independent and conscious decision to take and eat it. There's nothing gullible or simple-minded about her here.
Do you think that some theologians condemn Eve because she's acting independently here? She's making her own choices rather than seeking permission or advice from a man or from a male-identified deity. She's taking the lead and making decisions all by herself.
Yeah, that could be part of it. In a patriarchal world, Eve's agency could be seen as transgressive and even dangerous because women are supposed to be submissive to male authority rather than thinking and acting for themselves. So I think we can say that Eve is sometimes interpreted through these two very different but equally negative lenses. She's either accused of being weak and gullible and easily deceived, or she's maligned for being a subversive and dangerously independent woman who refuses to conform to gender norms of feminine passivity and submission.
And that reminds me of the way society today often makes sense of women who commit crimes or who break the rules. They're either viewed as mad, not in their right mind or incapable of rational thought, or they're labelled as bad, wicked and dangerous femme fatales who flout traditional norms of femininity.
Mm.
And sometimes they can even be viewed through both of these equally negative lenses. A good example I can think of is Patty Hearst. Okay, so Patty Hearst was an American heiress who was kidnapped in 1974 by a radical left-wing fringe group called the Symbionese Liberation Army, also known as the SLA. Patty was held captive by this group, and after several months, she appeared to become an active member, participating in at least two armed robberies alongside her captors. Now, she was eventually arrested by the FBI in 1975, and she was tried and convicted for her role in the armed robberies.
Wow, did she do jail time?
Yeah, she actually did. She was found guilty, although her sentence was later commuted, and I believe that she was eventually given a full pardon. But at the time, there was a lot of public speculation about her relationship with her captors and her seeming collusion in their crimes.
Yeah, I see how that relationship could be interpreted in a number of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for example, some people put her in the mad category of female criminals. They thought she was a victim of brainwashing, coercion, and deception. They described her as naive, traumatized, temporarily insane, and incapable of making rational decisions. But others labelled her as bad and saw her as a deceptive femme fatale who had willingly left behind her life of privilege to embrace criminality, radical politics, and sexual liberation. Patty was even accused of seducing some of her captors so that they would accept her into the group.
So, in other words, she's either got absolutely no willpower or she has way too much willpower.
Yeah, exactly.
And that reflects the two main criticisms so often directed at Eve.
It does. But what I find fascinating is that after Patty Hearst was jailed, she asked her lawyer to pass on the following message. It's read, "Tell everyone that I'm smiling, that I feel free and strong." And it reminds me a lot of what we've just been saying about Eve. And I wonder if perhaps Eve chose to feel free and strong by eating the forbidden fruit. And maybe that's her biggest crime, because women who want to feel free and strong are often seen as a threat to patriarchal power. They won't be passive or submissive. They won't play by the rules. They won't be told what they can and cannot do. So they have to be punished for that.
That is fascinating, Kaz, and I think you're onto something there. It's interesting you mentioned that Patty Hearst was accused of seducing her captors in the SLA, because that's something else she has in common with Eve. A frequent assumption made about the Genesis 3 narrative is that Eve used her sexuality to tempt and seduce Adam into eating the forbidden fruit.
Yes, and again, that temptress motif is so often used today to label women who are accused of criminality, of breaking the rules. I recall last season we mentioned Amanda Knox, who was accused of murdering her flatmate Meredith Kercher in 2007. Now, Amanda was later acquitted of the murder, but during her trial, she was portrayed by both the prosecution and the media as a sex-crazed femme fatale who had used her sexual allure to tempt her boyfriend, Raffaele Sollecito, and another male acquaintance, Rudy Guede, to participate in Meredith's rape and murder. Now, there was absolutely no evidence for this. In fact, at the time of Amanda's trial, Rudy Guede was already serving a sentence for Meredith's rape and murder. He and he alone committed this horrific crime. But the courts and the media believed the prosecution's narrative about Amanda's involvement because it confirmed societal fears that women can use their lethal sexuality to tempt men into a life of crime. Amanda was tried and convicted for her sexuality, not because there was any evidence that she was guilty of the murder.
Mm.
So if we take that back to Eve, Is there any evidence in the biblical text that she sexually tempted Adam into eating the forbidden fruit?
No, there really isn't. Genesis 3:6 simply says that she took the fruit and ate some of it. Then, quote, she also gave some to her man who was with her, and he ate. There is no sex. There is no seduction. Just two people who seem quite happy to eat fruit together.
Which sounds really innocent, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the text says Adam was with her. So I guess we can presume that he heard what the serpent said too, and that he saw Eve eating the fruit first, but, you know, he didn't try to stop her.
That would make sense, although it hasn't prevented theologians and biblical scholars trying to exonerate Adam here and shift the blame to Eve.
Ugh.
You read out a quote from Jerome earlier, Kaz. Well, he translated the Bible into Latin back in the 4th century, and his translation of Genesis 3:6 says, quote, she took of the fruit and did eat, and gave to her husband who did eat. Can you spot the difference?
What happened to the bit about Adam being with Eve?
Exactly. Now, the Hebrew text clearly says that he was with her. But when that phrase is omitted, we're left with the impression that Eve was alone when she spoke to the serpent and ate the fruit. And if that phrase is left out, then Adam can't be blamed for not stopping her, or for telling her to ignore what the serpent was saying. And then if we add into the mix the idea that Eve sexually tempted poor Adam to eat the fruit, then he becomes even less guilty.
Is the Latin Bible the only translation that omits the phrase?
No. There are actually quite a few versions of the Bible that leave it out, including some relatively recent translations. But by omitting that phrase, the act of transgression is focused solely on Eve, rather than Eve and Adam.
That actually reminds me again of Patty Hearst. The Symbionese Liberation Army were suspected of committing various criminal acts, including a murder that took place before they'd kidnapped Patty. But any articles you read about the SLA focus much more on Patty Hearst and her participation in the group's crimes. And I've rarely come across images of other SLA members, whereas you can easily find a very famous photo of Patty Hearst posing with an automatic rifle in front of an SLA banner. It's become a really iconic image.
Yeah, that was literally the first image that came up when I Googled the SLA just now.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, so just as the narrative about the SLA has become narrowed down and focused solely on Patty, the narrative of Genesis 3 has likewise been interpreted in ways that home in on Eve's role in the transgression, while Adam's culpability is effectively sidelined.
You're so right. There are some really interesting resonances between these two stories, eh?
Yeah.
When you read the Genesis narrative closely and in light of this contemporary crime narrative, it raises questions about whether Eve, like Patty, shoulders a disproportionate share of the blame here.
So when God discovers that Adam and Eve have eaten the forbidden fruit, does God focus on Eve's culpability? In other words, does God hold her more accountable than Adam?
No, I don't think God does. In Genesis chapter 3, verses 14 to 19, God outlines the repercussions of the transgression for the three individuals involved, so the serpent, Eve, and Adam. And what's clear is that Eve isn't singled out as the main or sole wrongdoer. She's no more guilty than either the serpent or Adam, in God's eyes at least. The serpent is cursed to go upon its belly and eat dust all the days of its life, and God warns that there will always be enmity between serpents and humanity. Adam is told that the ground is now cursed, so that working the land to produce food will be difficult and exhausting. And then there's Eve. Do you want to read out verse 16, Kaz, where God tells Eve how the transgression will impact her?
Sure, I'll use the NRSV updated translation. I'm quoting, I will make your pangs in childbirth exceedingly great. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you.
So what are your initial impressions of this, Kaz?
Well, I've often heard this verse being interpreted as an etiology and an origin story of labour pains during childbirth, But I do remember my Hebrew teacher many moons ago telling us that the Hebrew word translated pain here might refer to emotional pain rather than physical pain. In other words, childbirth will be emotionally difficult for women.
Yeah, I've heard that too. And it would make sense in the context of ancient Israel, where infant mortality rates were likely very high. So the pain mentioned here could refer to the mother's grief over losing her child. Biblical scholar Carol Myers also suggests that the Hebrew word translated as childbirth is more accurately translated as pregnancies, and pangs is better translated as toil or hard physical labour that came with living in an agricultural community. So she suggests a translation of this part of the verse as something like, "I will make very great your toil and your pregnancies, with anguish shall you have children."
Okay, so God is telling Eve that she will have to work very hard, and she will have multiple pregnancies, and her experience of motherhood will be filled with grief. But what about the last part of the verse? Your desire will be for your husband, but he will rule over you. Is God telling Eve that she will desire Adam, but she will have to be subordinate to him?
That's certainly how this part of the verse is often interpreted. I've even heard it suggested that Eve's desire is a desire to rule over Adam. So she might want to hold the power in the relationship, but God won't allow it. Eve's punishment is to be subordinated by her man.
But these are such problematic interpretations, aren't they? Because they effectively give men permission to subjugate their wives and partners, and they validate male authority and control by suggesting that women's subordination is necessary because of women's own sinfulness.
Yeah, women are essentially victim-blamed for their own subjugation. This idea that God reinforced gender hierarchy as a result of Eve's transgression is also a key part of the Christian ideology of complementarianism.
Can you remind us what that is, Em?
Sure. So complementarianism is based on the belief that God created men and women to have distinctive roles and responsibilities. They're equally valuable in God's eyes, but they're different from each other. Men are presented as the natural leaders of their families and communities, while women are expected to willingly submit to male authority, because that is God's design for gender roles and relationships. So, in this interpretation, Eve's decision to exercise her agency by eating the fruit and sharing it with Adam is understood as a transgression of this gender hierarchy. She failed to submit to the authority of both God and her husband, and as a result, she brought shame and dishonor upon both herself and Adam.
So in essence, a complementarian reading of Genesis 3, verse 16, effectively puts Eve back in her subordinate place by restoring the gender hierarchy. God wants to make clear that although she might desire to control her husband, he must always have authority over her. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But this reading of the text only serves to give biblical authority to ongoing gender inequalities and women's subordination. It sustains a gendered power imbalance that discourages women from exercising control over their lives and their relationships. And that's not okay, because even today there are women in both Jewish and Christian communities who suffer serious domestic violence and coercive control. And this verse, Genesis 3:16, is sometimes used to defend or justify it.
Yeah, and thinking about it more broadly, I'd also suggest that complementarian claims about men's God-given authority also tap into wider cultural beliefs about male entitlement.
Can you say a little bit more about that, Kez?
Sure. So our society is very adept at teaching men they are entitled to women's unquestioning loyalty and love, their compliance, even their submission. And we see time and again when a man feels his entitlement has been breached or undermined by his partner or ex-partner, the results can be catastrophic. Every day, women are threatened, coerced, raped, assaulted, and even murdered by the men who claim to love them. And one of the most dangerous times for abused and coercively controlled women is when they try to end that abusive relationship. Because by doing so, they're effectively rejecting their partner's attempts to control them, to rule them. Male entitlement drives abusive men to do anything they can to retain that control. So they stalk and terrorise their victims, sometimes even killing them. I read in a recent United Nations report that globally, over 31,000 women were murdered in 2020 by a partner or former partner. That's about 83 women a day, murdered by men who felt entitled to rule their female partners.
Goodness, that's an absolutely horrific statistic.
It really is. It's outrageous. But it makes me think back to Genesis 3, verse 16, and God's words to Eve that her desire will be for her husband, but he will rule over her. I wonder if her desire isn't for power and control. What she actually desires could be a loving and equitable relationship with her husband, a relationship that's based on mutual respect and freedom, rather than subordination and control. This is the relationship that she tried to establish with Adam when they spoke with the serpent together and when they both chose to eat the fruit together. But God seems to be saying to her, you can't have that. He must rule over you.
Yeah, perhaps God is telling her that from here on in, she will be submissive and subordinated in her relationship. But I don't think this gender hierarchy was intended by God at the outset of creation. As we've just seen, it doesn't characterize the relationship between Adam and Eve when they were in Eden. This hierarchy reflects life outside the garden. It's presented as a tragic outcome of the transgression, a transgression carried out by the human couple, not just Eve, both Adam and Eve. God's plan for creation included mutuality and equity between men and women, and between humanity and the earth. But after the transgression, outside of Eden, there can only be gender inequality, male control, and the distortion of healthy relationships. But that is not what God originally intended for humanity.
And it might not even be what Adam wants either, just as many men today are horrified by complementarian ideas about male headship and women's subordination. But because Adam ate the fruit with Eve, they both have to suffer this fractured relationship. Do we get any sense of how they get on with each other outside of Eden, Em?
So the only thing we really learn about their relationship in Genesis 4 is that they're having sex, which leads to Eve giving birth to three sons, Cain, Abel, and Seth. But beyond that, Eve and Adam don't really seem to interact with each other. And that's a far cry from Genesis 2, where Adam sang with joy when Eve was created, or Genesis 3, where they did so many things together, listening to the serpent, eating the fruit, creating clothes out of leaves.
So it sounds as though something has fundamentally changed in the relationship once they leave Eden.
Exactly. Although there's no sense in the text that Eve is subordinate to Adam. If anything, Genesis 4 offers us a glimpse of Eve's continued agency and power. The birth of her sons signal her role as the mother of all living. And after the birth of her first son, Cain, she declares, "I have produced a man with the help of the Lord." She doesn't mention Adam at all. It's as though she's co-creating life with God.
That is quite a powerful image, and I agree it does speak to Eve's continued agency, which I think is quite comforting after all the trauma at the end of Genesis 3. So, Em, what are you going to take away from our conversation about Eve?
Yeah, well, I'm really interested in the gap, or the chasm even, between what we find written about in the biblical text and the ways in which Eve has been portrayed throughout Christian history. As we've seen, Eve has been presented as inferior, subordinate to Adam, as derivative, as untrustworthy, gullible, simple-minded, and as solely responsible for bringing sin into the world. And we've seen how these characteristics have been taken to be characteristics of all women everywhere. But we've also seen that when we examine the text closely, not one of these interpretations is altogether accurate, and most are just not there in the story itself. I think I might have mentioned this in our last series, Kaz, but one of the questions I always get my students to think about is, whose interests are served in this reading of the text? So here we might ask, whose interests are served in portraying Eve, and by extension all women, in this way? And let's just say these interpretations don't serve the interests of women. So I think that rereading Eve, paying close attention to what the biblical text actually says, as we've done, is absolutely crucial for Eve herself, but also for women, and indeed people of all genders today.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's a really good point.
What about you, Kez?
Well, I feel as though I want to reclaim and rehabilitate this idea of Eve as every woman, which you mentioned near the start of the episode. I'd like to think that Eve is every woman, in the sense that she showcases women's desire for freedom, agency, and equality in their relationships. She engages with other than human creatures. She listens to them and learns from them. She shares her learning with her partner so that he can enjoy this knowledge-giving fruit as well. She isn't looking to have power and control over Adam or over God. She's looking for wisdom and enlightenment and the freedom to make the best that she can out of life, and to make mistakes and learn from them, and to break the rules every now and again. And if that's what every woman is looking for, then I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
Absolutely. I really love that reclamation of Eve's character, Kaz. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, shall we end today's episode by sharing with listeners what we've been listening to or reading recently?
Yeah, well, I've been listening to a fabulous podcast series called Female Criminals. I thought it was very apt, given that we're talking about Eve today. Mm. It's hosted by Vanessa Richardson, and she discusses a whole range of women throughout history who've stood accused of breaking the rules. It's really well done, and I love that Vanessa delves into the backstory of these women, and she highlights how societal norms around gender and sexuality can often shape the way these women's rule-breaking behaviour is understood. So I think it was really relevant to our discussion of Eve today as well. Mm. And Vanessa even has a couple of episodes on Patty Hearst. So I would definitely take a listen if you want to learn more about that story.
Yeah, I'll absolutely follow that up. I'm very keen to learn more about Patty Hearst.
So what have you been listening to, Em?
Well, I've been listening to a really brilliant podcast hosted by Lucy Worsley called Lady Killers. Basically, Lucy and her guests investigate the crimes committed by women from the 19th and 20th centuries. And what I really enjoy about their analysis is they're explicitly bringing a contemporary feminist perspective to investigate these historic crimes. It's fascinating.
Oh, it sounds it. And I love Lucy Worsley. Mm. She's great. So, thanks for listening to this episode of The Bloody Bible. The resources we used are listed in our show notes, which you'll find on our website, along with the links to our social media account.
But until next time, stay safe, everyone. See you soon.
Thank you for joining us for the first episode of Season 2 of The Bloody Bible Podcast, and a special thank you for listening all the way through to the credits. Please leave us a 5-star review. The Bloody Bible Podcast is supported by funding from the United Kingdom Arts and Humanities Research Council as part of the Shiloh Project Research Grant. A special thanks to Professor Johannes Stiebert at the University of Leeds, who commissioned us and supported us into the second series of the podcast. The podcast is produced by Carolyn Blythe, Emily Colgan, and myself, Richard Bonifant, who, just like in Series 1, is still having to apologise profusely on behalf of all men. Our music is Stalker by Alex Ortiz Sofield, courtesy of Pixabay Music, and the podcast artwork was created by Sarah Lee West. You can find links in the podcast notes for all of our social media. Please reach out to us, we'd love to hear from you.